are listening to Lighthearted, the official podcast of the United States Lighthouse Society. My name is Jeremy D'Entremont. Welcome. Today is June 8th, 2025, and this is episode 318 of Lighthearted. Back with me as co-host today, for the second episode lately, is Michelle Jewell Shaw, Chair of Friends of Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouses. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jeremy, and hello to all of our listeners out there.
It's really good to have you back as co-host for these two episodes. We kind of gave you a vacation from the podcast there for a few months. I know you've been super busy with your job as a special education teacher.
Yes, it definitely has been a very, very busy year, but it's definitely also nice to be back recording podcasts with you, Jeremy.
Well, you were one of the original co-hosts, so you'll always be a co-host of Lighthearted. Yes. So good to have you back. By the way, I was just reading an essay by a special education teacher about all the great things about the job. She wrote, quote, "As special education teachers, we have the good fortune of teaching some of the best kids at the school. Don't let the regular," and she put that in quotes, the word regular, "don't let the regular education teachers know that, though. They might try to take our jobs," unquote. So I think you probably feel the same way, Michelle.
Definitely. I love, special education students have a special place in my heart, and there's just no other feeling, than helping them be successful and in things that they want to succeed at. So it's great.
Yeah. What was you telling me about they're like Velcro students?
Oh yeah. So I've this group of students that I have this year, I've really created such a strong bond with, and it's going to be difficult to say goodbye to them in June. And a lot of them are always close by my side, no matter what time of the day. They're supposed to be in math class, and where can you find them? In Mrs. Shaw's classroom. So, there's the phrase that, teachers have Velcro students. And one of my students said that, no, we're not Velcro students. We're your super glue students. So, pretty funny.
Well, That's so nice.
Yeah.
People who've listened to the podcast since the beginning may remember that you got your teaching degree. I don't want to say late in life. That's not a good way to put it, but a little later than most people do. You raised your children. So it's only been a few years that you've been teaching, right?
Yep. This is my third year under my belt. I just renewed my teaching certification, and it no longer says my certificate no longer says new teacher, and now it says experienced educator. So, so that was exciting. So, yeah.
That's impressive. Experienced educator.
Yeah.
So, on behalf of everybody, I just want to say thank you to you and to all the dedicated teachers out there. I feel that teachers never get enough credit. You really have one of the most important jobs in the world. And I know as you're saying, your students certainly love and appreciate you. So, yes. So thank you so much for all that you do.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you for noticing that. Last week was Teacher Appreciation Week. So that was that's kind of good timing.
Yeah. Well, it should always be Teacher Appreciation Week. Yeah. So back to the podcast here. Today's a really special episode. For one thing, it's a discussion with two of my good friends in the world of Maine lighthouses, and also with another man who's a new good friend. The discussion is about one of the most important things facing lighthouses today. Please help me introduce the conversation, Michelle.
Sure, Jeremy. In January 2024, two powerful storms, just 3 days apart, struck northern New England, coinciding with the highest tide ever recorded in Portland, Maine, at 14.75 feet. The degree of damage was severe up and down the coast of Maine and New Hampshire, and about one-third of Maine's 66 historic lighthouse sites suffered significant damage.
According to the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, the Gulf of Maine is warming four times faster than the average rate of heating across all the world's oceans. As the Gulf of Maine continues to warm, sea levels will rise due to thermal expansion. This will lead to more flooding events in coastal areas, especially when combined with higher tides and stronger storm surges, all as a result of climate change.
The nonprofit American Lighthouse Foundation has formed a storm and mitigation response team that is dedicated to the development of a series of best practices that can help lighthouses become more resilient in the face of future storms. The effort has been boosted by the World Monuments Fund, which named Maine lighthouses to their 2025 watch list of places facing major challenges around the world.
Today's conversation is with three members of the team. Bob Trapani Jr. is the executive director of the American Lighthouse Foundation. Ford Reike is the president of the Presumpscot Foundation, which owns Halfway Rock Lighthouse in Maine's Casco Bay. And David Pomerantz has a background that spans construction management, state and federal grant management, climate resilience, and emergency management. And he's also been a lighthouse volunteer at Race Point and Baker's Island in Massachusetts. So let's listen to our conversation now. I'm speaking this afternoon with three friends, and the three who are taking part in this discussion are all members of the American Lighthouse Foundation Resilience and Mitigation Team. And we have Ford Reike, who is the president of the Presumpscot Foundation, which owns Halfway Rock Lighthouse and is currently applying for the ownership of Little Mark Island Monument in Casco Bay, a really interesting structure. And we have David Pomerantz, who is, again, also a member of this team and has a background in emergency management and climate resilience and mitigation. And also, David has been a longtime volunteer keeper at Race Point Lighthouse, which is under the American Lighthouse Foundation, and also at Baker's Island Light in Salem, Mass., two places that I really love. And my good friend Bob Trapani Jr., who is the executive director of the American Lighthouse Foundation and has really been a spearhead of this effort, this resilience and mitigation team. So Bob, Ford, and David, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, great to be here, Jeremy.
Nice to be here with you, Jeremy.
So it's a huge subject. Hard to know where to start, but I think maybe a good starting point would be the storms that happened a little over a year ago, January of last year. There were back-to-back storms that did tremendous damage on the coast of Maine, other places too, but particularly at lighthouse light stations on the coast of Maine. So, Bob, I don't know if you want to start, maybe say, without getting into tremendous detail about every single one, but just kind of an overview of what happens at Maine's light stations in those storms.
Oh, sure. As we know, those storms, January 10th and January 13th, it was near unprecedented types of damage, especially from storm surge, which was coupled with the big tides that we were having during that month. And literally, the damage was just, it ran the gamut at light stations, of course, on the coastal communities as well. But I think the one big thing when Ford and I first started talking about the aftermath of that storm was, it's like, okay, we're starting to see the news come in about what's had been damaged along our coastal communities, harbors. But this was January, it was winter, boats are out of the water, and it's like most of Maine's lighthouses are offshore. And it's like nobody had any idea what we were dealing with. Ford, and then you can say, what did we do next?
I'll add one more thing about the storms. Because it's something I didn't understand until right after the storms. These were modest winter ocean storms. But they did coincide, as Bob said, with very high tides. In Portland, it was the highest tide ever recorded. And we know, we've all been reading that ocean temperatures in the Gulf of Maine are climbing faster than anywhere else in the world almost. That's accurate. And I couldn't figure out how that related, how increasing water temperatures necessarily were causing the highest tide we'd ever seen. And what I learned is the conventional wisdom. The Gulf of Maine is like a big bathtub, one way in, one way out. So there's not a great deal of water exchange. It's very close to the Gulf Stream, but not in it. And it's fairly shallow. So it just has all of the physical characteristics that would allow the water temperature to really increase with a slight change in the Gulf Stream. That's temperature change. Why is water level going up? And that's because of what's called thermal expansion. Everyone knows that when something is heated, it expands. So it's simply because the water gets warmer, it takes up more space. And even though you hear the saying water seeks its own level, it doesn't. The water is at a high, at sea level in the Gulf of Maine is different than sea level in the rest of the world. So that's, I just wanted to make that comment to tie that back to climate change and what the temperature difference does to our water level.
Yeah, Thanks for clarifying that, Ford. So in a way, it was kind of like, you know, of course, we had the famous perfect storm back in 91, but this was almost another example of sort of a perfect or imperfect combination of ingredients, including that king tide that happened around then. And to have back-to-back storms 3 days apart like that, I mean, that's highly unusual. First one was bad enough, and the second one was worse.
The thing I find troubling about that, Jeremy, is that the perfect storm, the one in 79...
Or 91, actually.
91, rather. And also, there was another storm back in 79 in February. Those are infrequent. What we're seeing with these high tides is they're much more frequent. So the thing I find most scary about this is that what happened in January is by no means an isolated or once in every 5 year occurrence going forward.
Right. And moving back a little bit from that, in December 2022, 2 days before Christmas, there was a major coastal storm that I'm in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And of course, that storm, as I think you all know, did tremendous damage at Portsmouth Harbor Light. It washed out a footbridge to the lighthouse. The storms last year also did great damage there. But and also I'll mention that I've been involved with Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouse for just about 25 years now, and by far the four worst floods I've seen there, floods caused by storms, the four worst have been in the last 4 years by far. Before that, there was nothing comparable.
Right.
So it certainly does seem to be happening more often.
Well, to tie up our storm response there, and initially, Jeremy, to tie up our question on that. So there we are, you know, there's this assessment going on what was damaged all along the coast of Maine and New Hampshire, and lighthouses aren't in that discussion. So that's when Ford Reike and I took to the air on January 29th to do an assessment from Seguin Island at the entrance of the Kennebec River all the way up to Winter Harbor in Frenchman Bay. And in all, we discovered approximately 23 light stations suffering various levels of damage. So approximately one third of Maine's lighthouses were damaged by these storms. So I just tie that all together.
Yeah. And you said you and Ford took to the air. I just want to make sure people understand. You're not talking about you went on radio, but you went up in a helicopter to view.
Yeah, it's a helicopter for sure.
That coincided with a real realization for me that all these lighthouses that have been transferred from the federal government to other owners in the state of Maine, of our 66 lighthouses, only 18 are left in federal hands. Is that right, Bob?
Yes. If you count the Fish and Wildlife and the Coast Guard, yes.
So 18 of the 66 are in federal hands. The balance have been transferred to local communities, a few private parties, some very modest friends of groups, and in every case, without significant resources. So after those two storms, Bob and I were on the phone wondering, well, what'd you hear about Seguin? What'd you hear about this island, this lighthouse? And we didn't have any information. And I thought, you know, that's because it's January and these aren't facilities with staff and boats and so forth. So that to me is a real element of this whole discussion of these lighthouses being in private hands with a new level of threat that's never been anticipated when the transfers were made. But that, yeah, so Bob and I, because we couldn't get any information, Bob did an informal count, just a projection. He said, I bet two dozen lighthouses got whacked. We don't know. So that's why we rented a helicopter.
Yeah. When you say two dozen lighthouses, really more specifically light stations, components of these light stations, in many cases, boathouses and things like that. Is that right?
That's correct, Jeremy.
That's an important point.
Yeah, just to elaborate on that a little bit, Jeremy, you know, it's not just the lighthouse itself. For the most part, the lighthouses are in pretty good condition. When you also consider the fact that the storms are increasing, as we just talked about previously, and where these light stations were originally constructed, you know, exposed to the elements to the 10th degree, it's really the light stations that are doing the best with these increasing storms and impacts. It's the infrastructure. So all your utilities, your boat ramps, your walkways, your ramps, outbuildings, the whistle houses, oil houses, that's where the majority of the damage is occurring. So, and some of it extremely significant.
One more point to what David and Ford are saying is the access for volunteers even was damaged. And I think that's key because, you know, if you can't even get onto the island, if you can't bring contractors out there. So the access points were also part of that. And to David's point with the life station structures, they all tell a story. Jeremy, you've seen all these light stations over the years. Some of them lost all their outbuildings, and there's this lonely lighthouse. And it's like, well, there was a much bigger complex, a much bigger story that was told. So when we see these structures damaged or lost, part of that history goes.
Lighthouses, light stations are very much on the front line of this battle, this ongoing battle. It's obvious that that's part of why they're so threatened. But what makes lighthouses unique concerning mitigation efforts?
One thing that makes them unique, I think you've touched on this, Jeremy, one thing that makes them unique in terms of harm is they were built in harm's way. I mean, what structures are in more dangerous spots than lighthouses? Something that, to answer your question specifically about what makes them unique with respect to mitigation efforts and even repairs, they're in remote spots, hard to get to. That's something that Dave or Bob can speak to. But most the point I'd like to make is most of them are on the National Historic Register. They have, when a building is on the National Historic Register, in most cases and in all cases with lighthouses that I know of, you cannot modify the outside of the structure without federal government approval, which is usually delegated to the states from the Department of Interior to the State Historic Preservation Officer. You can't modify them without approval. And when you talk about mitigation, it's absolutely modification. It's storm shutters. It may be elevating the building, strapping the building down with cable ties. This is an anomaly because when the historic preservation regulations were drafted, no one imagined the climate was going to change or that the rules of existence and engagement were going to change. So that's a challenge for operating under these federal historic preservation rules. And then you have dealing with your local code enforcement officer because you need building permits for this work. And it's on the shore, so every state has extensive regulations for doing anything near the shore. There also is a federal regulation that says that if a building in a flood zone is more than 50% damaged, it can't be rebuilt. And the way they assess 50% damage is they go by value. So I had a code enforcement officer here in Maine who was lovely to deal with, but had never been through this before. It took me 3.5 months just to get a building permit to start my storm damage repair and my mitigation work.
Yeah, Jeremy, just from a different perspective to your question about what makes lighthouses unique as far as mitigation is concerned, you know, Bob writes eloquently all the time about the history and what they represent. And as a keeper out at both Baker's and Race Point, I do tours all the time, and it's amazing. People come out, regardless of their political, economic, social, geographic ilk, and they're just fascinated to go up in the tower and hear the history of what these stations, how they came about and what they are today. And then if there still active aids to navigation, all the more reason to ensure that mitigation and resilience is done properly. Just as an aside, my son is a commercial airline pilot. He flies all over the world. And even though with their high-tech technology and electronic equipment and satellite tracking data, more than I could ever imagine is crammed into those planes, they still look for lighthouses when they're coming in on approaches or flying over someplace at 4 o'clock in the morning. They'll check their charts, and if they see a lighthouse beacon on, it's reassuring, as my son says, and it confirms where they are. Yeah. So here we are, you know, hundreds of years after lighthouses were first developed, and they're still interwoven into so much of what our lives are all about.
I think one more concern, and there are many, actually, we're not going to be able to touch on all of them. I think another concern that on top of what Ford and David have already stated, I think is just the logistics. So many lighthouses being offshore, finding professionals, contractors to be able to do this work who are capable. Then, as Ford touched on the Section 106 component, you also have to have contractors that are well-versed in working with historic properties. So not, you know, they're sensitive sites, as we know. So I think even just coordination, whether it's marine engineers, architects, and contracting, to be able to carry this mitigation work out effectively and comply with standards, it's definitely a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, if there were greater mitigation efforts before those storms in January of last year, would the damage have been more limited?
Great question. This is the optimistic note in this whole saga. The answer is yes, because this, as Dave said earlier, the damage was not to these stone towers. It was to wooden buildings that can be beefed up with armor and to docks that can be secured to the ledge and put in sacrificial decking so that it presents less resistance to the waves. So if affordable mitigation efforts had been in place for those storms, we would have seen much less damage. Mm-hmm. Is that an exaggeration?
No, it's not.
No. In fact, this would be a great segue, Bob, for you to talk about, you know, the initial rollout of the best practices that we've been compiling and what that process is all about.
Yes, it would definitely have helped. I think on top of what Ford has stated already, I think in the lighthouse world, this is a great opportunity for us to reassess how we view our light stations. Oftentimes we leave structures like boathouses and oil houses and whistle houses more towards the back end of our restoration plans. We focus on the lighthouse and the keeper's house. Have we invested more resiliency, repaired foundations better? Yes, we definitely could have mitigated a bunch of that harm that we saw happen. So now that's not addressing the rising sea levels, but in terms of the storm surge and how it was able to move some of these structures, yes, definitely we could have improved on that.
Right. And then there's the right, as you just said, there's the question moving on to what greater mitigation efforts are going to be needed. Mm-hmm. But this might be a good point to define what is the American Lighthouse Foundation Resilience and Mitigation Committee. I think I have the name correct.
So the team was really, the concept of the team came together in April of 2024. As Ford and I initially were working through these things, it was just, we realized that this was a big issue. Really, it's connected, but yet separate from the normal preservation activities. And so the concept was, okay, let's form a team that can actually address this, dedicate itself to that. I'll give you an example. A lot of what we heard initially right out of the gate in the aftermath of the storm was people really just didn't know where to go and what to look for. And so the way we view the team is that it's more of a compass. It's like a compass. It's going to be able to point people in the right directions towards solutions. The other thing that the team is doing is along the way, we're going to create a roadmap of how to address it, where to go, so that the future, the stewards coming behind us, will be able to know, hey, this is what happened. This is how we addressed it. That doesn't mean things won't change. But right now, after the January storms, there was none of that in place for the main lighthouse community or really the national lighthouse community. There just isn't. So the opportunity was there, and that's really the impetus for the team to come about.
Is there an eventual aim or goal or goals the committee is aiming towards?
Yeah, so I'll start with this because it's good. I could take up a long time, and I don't want to do that. So basically, what the team decided to do offset was take the information that we were gathering and really come up with an easy approach to best practices that the average lighthouse group could take, whether they be modest or higher priced, you know, what have you. In the meantime, the committee is still talking to policymakers, SHPO, people who are in the marine engineering field, and what we're doing is we're compiling information. And then in conjunction with what the team is doing, and we'll get to this later, but I'll just throw it in here, in connection to the World Monuments Fund and Maine's lighthouses on the watch list, there's going to be case studies. So the data and research collected from the eight case studies will be added to what the team is doing from a survey perspective, an assessment. So together, there's going to be a lot of information to be gleaned. This is going to take a little bit of time. I mean, I know we're a year out already from the storms, but the data collection is a process. So yeah, we're going to just implement that as we go along the way.
Speaking more to your two questions back, and that was about the formulation of the mitigation team and the benefit of it. The disciplines that are represented on that team, emergency response, structural engineer, marine contractor, owners, certainly two FEMA experts, lighthouse technicians, covers a lot of the people who have hands-on responsibility for these problems. And I think that's an opportunity to bring together more expertise than is going to be done by any government agency. And, you know, already when we talk to FEMA or state agencies, they're very interested to see this work product.
How many people on the committee at this point? And part two of that question is, I imagine it sounds like there's a lot of people who aren't maybe officially on the committee, but are still, you know, have some input involvement with it as well.
Well, there's eight people on the committee. And David, you can speak to that as far as how we're trying to bring in other experts in this too as well. So they're not active on the committee, but
right. So one of the things that the committee has done or is doing, Jeremy, is looking for expertise that covers a whole range of topics that are relevant to what the work of the committee is. So as an example, you know, we have invited and had people on our Zoom calls to talk about everything from historic preservation in Maine and what those programs are like. We've talked with some engineering people that are actually, you know, on the water every day and explaining to us, you know, what the issues are from their perspective. So that's the role of the team, both internally and what we see as far as helping not just the stewards that are out there, but also, you know, public and private groups, state and federal agencies, is advocacy and education as well. So we may do things such as craft articles that we posted on the ALF site. We may be looking at doing, we talk about emergency management, there's the planning and there's the response piece. I think it would be very helpful in conversations I've had with some of these stewards in the Portland area to talk about pre-planning, doing assessments of their properties. How do you do that? Look at emergency planning, even if it means having some sheets of plywood in the keeper's house. So if a storm does roll through, the storm surge can quickly be addressed by covering up areas where it might have breached the building and prevent larger and more costly damage. So there's a lot of different avenues. You know, we're still learning as we go, almost 1 year into this committee. It's a great group of people, really diverse backgrounds, but we're all linked by that desire to really protect these historic resources going forward.
I will say one thing. I do agree with what Ford said in just a little bit earlier about how this team is, in a way, really better positioned than the government to help. Because I can speak, when you look at FEMA and that is there to help you, but I mean, it's just like for the average person, it's a very daunting experience. And I think what this team will be able to do is distill down what in a practical way, from practical experience, be able to help others enter those processes, which they will enter, but do so with a little bit more confidence, a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more understanding of it from a layman's perspective and how it does practically tie into lighthouses.
And again, without getting deeply at all into the politics of the matter, there is the present climate of federal government not being involved in climate change mitigation whatsoever. So maybe somebody's got to do it. So I'm glad.
Yeah, moving ahead in spite of the government.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Bob, a few minutes ago, you mentioned the World Monuments Fund. Tell me about the listing on the watch list, the inclusion on the watch list of Maine's lighthouses. Tell me what that's all about.
Oh, I'm happy to, Jeremy. It's actually a cool story. As we talked about earlier, Ford and I originally, we were just talking to all kinds of people about this. So one of our meetings was with Sarah Bronin, who was the Senate-appointed chair for the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation in Washington, D.C. And we met with her to talk about this plight on lighthouses, which she actually had an interest in because she actually wrote a climate article earlier in The Hill that was talking about the Pemigewig Point damage. So that was really cool. We connected on that. Anyway, during the conversation, she provided some wonderful guidance. And one of the advice was, why don't you bring this, why don't you nominate Maine's lighthouses to the World Monuments Fund? And so, Ford, I'm going to take it from there.
I will. And also, so Sarah Bronin, I'm going to back up a little bit too. We really, I think, did an effective job of getting the word out after these storms, after we figure out, you know, what is the story to be told here and how do we want help? We tried very hard to get the word out. And there were newspaper stories that we helped to write, magazine article, TV presentations. We nominated all of Maine's lighthouses to at the state level with an organization called Maine Preservation, and got all of Maine's lighthouses named to their most endangered list because of climate change. And we made our way to the woman who's the chair of the Congressional Advisory Committee on Historic Preservation. And this is the longstanding committee that advises the White House, maybe different White Houses, but the White House and Congress on historic preservation. So we're on the phone with this, with Sarah Bronin, who's the chair. And she heard the stories Bob said, and she said, you should nominate this to the World Monuments Fund watch list. So it is, the World Monuments Fund has been around since 1986. It is very rare that they name endangered historic treasures, which are in the United States. But every 2 years, they receive nominations, about 200 or 225 per year. And with the help of Maine Preservation, we submitted Maine lighthouses as a group because of the threat to climate change. And we were selected. First time ever for the state of Maine, first time ever for any lighthouse, of course. It is, that brings a modest amount of money, I think, directly from the World Monuments Fund. But an enormous amount of global recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jeremy, on the climate change aspect, I know Ford can attest to this as well. Maine's lighthouses and the Swahili coast of Africa were the only two sites that were actually selected due to the threat of climate change. I mean, there's other aspects like Ukraine, Gaza, the conflict, what's that doing, the historic sites and the tourism industry. But we're proud of the fact that Maine's lighthouses were one of the two sites worldwide selected for the threat that climate change is. But it's dubious, but it's actually good because it's going to help raise awareness, much needed awareness for these structures.
Let me ask you, I imagine people listening, some people might think, well, yeah, so there's all this damage, but don't people have insurance that's going to pay for repairs of these places? So how do you answer that? I see all of you almost laughing at that question. So, yeah.
I don't know of any lighthouse that has insurance. Do you, Dave or Bob?
No. Not that kind of insurance anyway.
Not that kind of insurance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're going to maintain property insurance, but it certainly is not going to be applicable to the volume of cost, to address the cost, rather, that they might be looking at for not just emergency repairs, but permanent repairs and mitigation.
From my own experience, Halfway Rock and Little Mark Island are uninsurable, period.
Yes.
Yeah. Except, yeah. Well, can you have property insurance that covers like maybe fire, vandalism, things like that, but not, nothing like that even?
You can't get you can't get fire trucks out there. So no, just no insurance at all.
Yeah. So Jeremy, I think just an easy explanation is that, of course, flood insurance was totally unaffordable for lighthouses. So, of course, when we're dealing with climate aspects, it's flood is going to be a big part of that. And then we're finding that wind is being removed because it's too much of a risk for the insurance company. So if you can't cover flood and you can't cover wind, property insurance does nothing to help you recover from these types of disasters.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Bob, you've been director of the American Lighthouse Foundation, what's a little over 20 years now, right?
It's showing with my gray hair.
Well, no, I'm not saying that, but it was different back then, right? I mean, you could have insurance that covered these things back then. Am I correct in that?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. I mean, flood was always going to be a tough one, but definitely wind, which is really important because, I mean, you get these – in the storms we saw in January, wind wasn't as big of a factor, but – you know, you get wind driving seas, you get wind bringing trees down, you get wind ripping roofs off of structures. It real fast becomes a problem. But yeah, this is really, I think, Jeremy, I won't speak across the board, but I think that storms of 22 and others and other losses prior, the insurance companies as of 23 started to take a very different look at wind exposure. So yeah, that's when we started to see the cracks in the armor and then going away altogether.
Well, let me ask you, what is the role of federal agencies like FEMA, MEMA? Well, MEMA's Maine, right? What's the role of agencies like that in all this?
They have historically had very few requests for support from lighthouses and have even more infrequently supported them. The Presumpscot Foundation has been dealing with FEMA on for Halfway Rock, and they've been cooperative, but we're a year and a half into it and don't have a resolution yet. They're doing the best they can with a strange set of rules.
Yeah, and things are changing by day these days.
Yeah, and I'll add further. Ford had alluded to the fact of how many lighthouses, you know, there's approximately 18 still in Maine held by the federal government. So if you, like, for instance, for ALF, any lighthouse with a Coast Guard license was not eligible for FEMA. So we know Portsmouth Harbor, Wood Island, those types of places, we're not going to be eligible for FEMA funds. I think the other thing, too, is that the layers of review are being added because, like, I know right now in the state of Maine, MEMA has not been provided with the funds to release because of more review that has been added to the process. So as Ford just stated, I mean, just to his situation at Halfway Rock a year and a half into, I think the one thing, if that aid is going to come, I think we all need to be prepared for that aid to be very slow in coming, and you have to be able to protect these places in the meantime. And then at that, you've and again, Ford could speak to this with his experience at Halfway Rock, but there are things you can and can't do as you're going through that process. So it's an interesting one.
Jeremy, just to pick up on Bob's point about not so much the volume of aid, but the timing of the aid. Especially when you're in coastal zone areas, you can have quite sizable timeframes and costs associated with permitting, whether it's getting a permit from, you know, the local building department. I'm sure you need it for working in Portsmouth Harbor. But there's also state agencies that are going to want to weigh in. And, you know, if you're involved in an area where the Army Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction of any sort, they're going to want to get involved in the permitting process. And you can't say permitting without saying cost and time. So it's not simply filing a building application like you want to build a garage behind your house and you get the permit in a week.
So that's a good point, Dave. We got the environmental aspect of that. I mean, Jeremy, just to bring it back to Portsmouth, I mean, just like the piers for the walkway, if they're destroyed, you're drawing a permit to reestablish those piers. So.
Yeah, right. Just back to FEMA for a second. I'm just remembering how I think it was a storm in 2007 that washed out a covered walkway at White Island Lighthouse in the Isles of Shoals off the New Hampshire coast. FEMA funds paid for the rebuilding of that walkway. And then was it the same storm, Bob, that did some damage to the roof at the Nubble Light in York, Maine? I think it was.
Yeah.
And they got FEMA funds as well. So it was happening back then. It was slow, but it happened. You know, it seems even more difficult now. So,
well, I think David probably could answer this question better, but I will say that it does appear that if you are a municipality or, you know, a state agency, there's a better path forward for FEMA funds than there is for nonprofits. I think that's a fair statement.
Yes. That's a good point. However, they're not going to be driving up and handing you a check with 15 zeros on it if you're a municipality. if you are looking at doing emergency repairs, I think it's going to be easier to find funding, both state and federal, than right now, than to start talking about mitigation and long-term resilience, which is going to be certainly more costly, but no less critical is the need to do those emergency repairs. So, you know, if there's the next storm, which we all know there's going to be, you're at least protecting things as you try to move towards more permanent repairs or mitigation and resilience improvements.
Another thing I've heard, I think, in our discussions recently, guys, is that you have an intern. You will be having an intern from the University of New England, which is in Biddeford, Maine, working with you. Can you explain what that's about?
Yes, the University of New England has a nationally prominent marine sciences program, and so we have an intern from their student body to help with the work for the World Monuments Fund survey. So being named to the World Monuments Fund watch list comes with the responsibility to put together a plan to assess what your threat was, what the impact of your particular ice threat amounted to, and how to perhaps prevent it in the future. And
it's a great opportunity, Jeremy. I mean, it's part of the sustainability fellowship program for UNE. And so Ford and myself and Cameron Wake, who's a director there, will be serving as mentors for this intern. And it is tied directly, as Ford said, to the World Monuments Fund. And what that program will glean from these 8 sites that will be a part of the case studies not only goes back to what we were talking about earlier as far as data collection, but it will also drive things like workshops for preservation and mitigation that the WMF wants to conduct in this 2-year program, and other public outreach events as well. So it's a very important effort, and we're really happy to have UNE as a partner in all of this.
So kind of cutting to the chase here, let me ask any or all of you, this is kind of a 2-part question. Where do we go from here? Part A of that is in the short term, where do we go from here? And part B to that is in the long term, where do we go?
These storms, and it's no overstatement, they certainly changed the conversation and course of lighthouse preservation as we know it today. And I think what it pointed out to us is that we have heard a lot about climate change, but are we listening to that, really that plight that is facing these light stations? And I think that is the part in the short term. It's a combination of enacting affordable measures that can help our light stations, but also being able to educate and raise awareness, because this takes a team. Really the importance and the urgency of both the short term and the long term. So what we do in the short term is extremely important because it sets the tone. And then where we go from there, yes, a lot of these constructs are going to take some time to build, but if we can kick this off with enthusiasm, like I believe we have, I think that's definitely going to help the success of the long term.
I'll just build a little bit on what Bob said, and that is, if you look at a lot of the light stations that have been transferred, you have these nonprofits, small groups of people. They may not have the expertise to try to figure out both emergency planning and then mitigation and resilience efforts. And it's no different on the municipal side. If there are light stations that are owned by municipalities, and then they may have a memorandum of agreement with nonprofits to maintain them and run them and do tours, even the municipalities, having worked long-term in local government, they don't know what they should really be doing. There's so many things that need to be addressed that our role can certainly be one of education, presenting information, developing these case studies on best practices, helping these nonprofit stewards at least take those first steps with the emergency planning to hopefully minimize the damage from the next storms, as well as know what they can start to think about doing on the mitigation and improving for increasing resilience side as well.
My concern that the storms we had last year are going to be repeated next year, in 3 years after that, and 5 years from now. We're just going to be in this cycle. And here we are a year and a half after those last storms. Many of the lighthouses that were damaged have not been repaired. I don't think any of them have been completely repaired or fully mitigated for what's coming next. So, and as David just said, regulations aren't catching up. Money hasn't caught up. So, we can't get too many storms behind here before we have a real problem on our hands.
Yeah. You kind of, almost answers. I was thinking of asking one more question. Okay. I will go ahead and ask and it's for bonus points. Okay. And I'll toss it up in the air and any of you can grab it. And again, maybe you'd already answered it, Ford, but how do you feel moving forward? Are you optimistic or not about the future of our main lighthouses against these forces?
Well, I think, I'll take a shot at it. Am I optimistic? Yes, but also realistic. I will say that me personally, I dread the thought of the possibility of losing certain light stations or structures, but these things may happen, and I think we have to be prepared for that. But at the same time, I believe in the power of what people can do who come together, and what we think may be impossible today may not be quite as impossible tomorrow. And, if you look at climate change as a storm, so to speak, unto itself, we need to be the light in that storm. And that doesn't mean we're not going to have challenges or we might even fail at spots along the way. But even if we fail, we're going to be learning. And I think some of the life's best learning is even in failing. So I don't even look at failure as a bad thing. I look at it as another opportunity. And in the end, if we're successful in safeguarding as much as possible of our historic light station fabric, that's what this is all about.
I'm generally optimistic. I think you do need to be realistic. We will, and our own SHPO, our own State Historic Preservation Officer, shared with us very early in the process after those storms that the day may come that you need to make decisions on which survive and which don't. But I think most of these structures will survive. I think the ancillary structures, the boathouses, the docks, the outbuildings are definitely in danger. But these lighthouses are mostly stone, and they are on the main rock-bound coast. If we had a lot of erosion problems along the main coast, this would be much, much more threatening. But that's for the most, with two or three exceptions, that's not the case.
Right. Yeah. If we had sandy cliffs like on Cape Cod or someplace like that, we'd be talking about possibility of moving a bunch of them probably, which we haven't discussed that at all, but that enters into the conversation eventually, but maybe in part two, we can talk about that.
Yeah, sure.
David, anything you want to add to what?
Just to, am I optimistic? Yes. And realistic? Yes. I have always felt, because I grew up with the Fire Island Lighthouse across the bay from the village I grew up in Long Island, as a beacon for me. And I see it. I mentioned this before. I see it all the time when I'm out at Race Point and Baker's Island, how people come to the island and come to Race Point and what the light stations mean to them and how they affect them. And I'm a firm believer that resilience for the light stations, making people see or helping people see how that impacts them and that makes them feel, we can expand that to look at climate change beyond the light stations.
David and Ford and Bob, thank you so much. I'd say I feel a little more optimistic than I did maybe an hour ago. So, and as you kind of touched on, Bob, I see you guys as lights in the storm. The committee is very much a light in the storm as we move forward. So thank you on behalf of Lighthouse fans and just people who love the New England coast and our coastlines in general. Just thank you for the work you're doing. I think it's really important. Maybe we can do a part two sometime moving forward, catching up on the progress of the committee and all that's happening. But I'll also mention Ford and Bob. Of course, you've been on the podcast a number of times. You guys are veterans, but I just want to welcome you to the lighthearted family as well, David. So
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you all so much. It was great talking with you.
Thanks for all you do, Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you for amplifying this, Jeremy. It's important.
Yes.
That's part of what we're talking about, so we appreciate you spreading the word.
You can follow the progress of the Storm and Mitigation Response Team on the American Lighthouse Foundation website at lighthousefoundation.org.
You know, it didn't come up much in this discussion, Michelle, because the discussion was about Maine lighthouses, but Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouse here in New Hampshire took a huge beating in those storms last year. Our local group here, the Friends of Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouses, needs to not only restore the lighthouse, but to prepare for future storms. It's very much an ongoing process.
It is an ongoing process that, you know, will never be complete. We'll have to be constantly evolving our methods to, you know, keep up with future storms and things like that.
I'm sure we'll be talking more about this in the podcast in the future. So we're actually recording this in mid-May, but on June 2nd, I'll be heading to France for most of the month. I'll be taking part in the U.S. Lighthouse Society's tour. I'm also going to spend a little time on my own in Paris and Brittany. It'll be my first time in France. This is all very exciting.
I'm sure it is. And I've got to say, Jeremy, I'm very jealous that I am not going to France this summer to visit lighthouses. That's definitely a bucket list trip for me, as are, you know, Scotland, all, you know, seeing lighthouses all over the world. But I hope you have a wonderful time.
Well, thank you. And I'd fit you in a suitcase if I could, but I'm going to be packing pretty tight. You
know? Yeah.
I expect to have a great time. And just for people who don't know, the U.S. Lighthouse Society runs tours all over the world every year. There's a trip to the Azores this season as well as a few domestic ones. And next year's tours are listed on the site. So if you go to uslhs.org and look under tours, you can read all about it. So do you have any plans for your summer break this year, Michelle?
Not really any traveling. Maybe a couple of days up at the lake. Lots of lake days and beach days. I hope to go visit the lighthouse a lot this summer. Maybe not for tours, obviously, but just to go visit the space. And it's been a while since I've been down there. So
yeah,
just lots of relaxation this summer.
Yeah. Well, we have a beautiful area to relax in. You don't have to go too far. The lakes region and the mountains and the seacoast, and you can't ask for more
right
than you have here.
Right.
Just one more thing about the tours. I believe a couple of spaces have opened up on the USLHS Cape Cod tour in September, which I'll be co-leading with my niece, Tina Hans. You can check that out. And again, all the upcoming tours at uslhs.org. And while you're on the site, you can read about preservation grants, the research catalog, the quarterly journal, and all the things the Society offers.
If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us.
Michelle, thank you again so much for co-hosting these last two episodes.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
We will have a special Lighthearted Light episode next week, and 2 weeks from now, we'll have an episode that's all about memories of Simon Ponsart Roberts, and her two daughters are the guests. Simon was a lighthouse keeper's daughter. I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to help her publish a book about her family's years at lighthouses. So that's going to be a very special episode. For now, to all our regular listeners and our new ones, thanks so much for listening, and
keep a good light. Let it shine, this little light of mine.